themselves, because that's where the decisions are being made. The plant manager, the plant operator, the rest of them have to follow these orders. And it gets very difficult, because many of them are saying they don't want to do it either. And one of the problems we run into often in communities is that people who work in the plant at all different levels won't come out to the meetings because they feel guilty. As if somehow it was their fault that this community has been poisoned. And, you know, you could say to one extent, well, it was. They could have quit their job, but, you know, who's going to feed their family? It wasn't their decision. It never is their decision. And, you know, we have to, like, say these things, I think, and talk about these things very bluntly, that, you know, you shouldn't feel guilty. You aren't guilty. You didn't make the decision. You know, and you got to feed your family. And, you know, this is the way you have to work for the inside. But really start talking about those things in very frank ways in which we can really define who they are and who we are.
I want to ask Lois a question along the line as well, which is, I thought in your presentation you were hopeful at the end there and sort of a little upbeat about the possibility of a resurgence of political force now that the Bush administration is here. Can you say just a little bit more about, I mean, this is a good line. I like it. Can you give us a little evidence as to what you think gives you that hopefulness at this point?
Well, one is obvious. he owns all the petrochemical investments, you know, and he's not interested in workers. He's interested in making more profits. But other than the obvious, there's actually three things that are happening. First of all, that obvious, so everybody puts him in doubt, where Clinton and Gore, it was only a passive doubt about whether they would succeed or carry out their promises. The other thing is that we are now going into a recession. And when people are not as comfortable, they stand up and look for things to fight about. And, you know, if he's in office for any length of time, you know, we're all going to be in serious financial trouble, I believe. The top 2% or 5% would not. But when people are uncomfortable, when people are worried about their jobs and because of the economy more so than the particular plant and stuff, and the more and more uncomfortable they get, the more they want to get involved. So I think that's going to help us a great deal. And also, I think that people are now realizing beyond, we had a huge movement, lots of different movements historically, and it's been a long time since we've had a real movement in this country. And people are getting uncomfortable, and people don't like it any longer. They don't feel like they have a say. I mean, at least what I'm seeing in the streets. And they really want some leadership. They really want to get on something to make some changes. And so I think that's also going to feed into it. People really want to be part of something, and part of something that creates change for themselves and their families. So I think the combination of all three of those. And then, you know, he's just goofy. You know? He looks like Howdy Doody. He's just sort of goofy. You know? I don't have much faith in him.
Okay. Hi, my name is Thomas Lillian. I'm Executive Director of Orange Grassroots Initiative. And I have actually a two-part question, one for Dr. Gaius and one for Lois. I'd like to know, first of all, a few months ago I had the chance to testify with a bunch of other environmentalists about supporting the Massachusetts Environmental Justice legislation. We also gave some testimony about changing the Toxic Use Reduction Act. And I'd like to know if you could give us an update of sort of where things are in terms of toxic use reduction and the right to know, specifically Massachusetts, and where you think that's going. And for Lois, I don't know if you remember, but when dying from dioxin came up, you spoke at NECA, with Essex Community College, and you talked about the incinerators along Merrimack Valley. And we were part of a coalition that actually forced two of them to close. And one of the things that we found out, though, now that we've gotten our two incinerators to close, and we've won a few victories in Lawrence, which is a predominantly Latino community, 23rd poorest community in the United States, is unless we keep finding big, I call them sexy targets, big boogeymen to go after, we're not going to have a lot of success. And what we've been trying to do, but we're having, you know, a lot of challenges. is in a poor Latino community where there's some really strong linguistic and cultural barriers between people who are activists and people who are just working people. What are the things, what are the strategies that you think work in terms of organizing effectively over the long term in that community? It's not, we're trying some things with like having people, training people to be activists and have house parties. We're trying to work in coalition with groups that have a lot of minority representation. I hate the word minority, Latino representation. But what are some strategies that you've seen? Because I work, in fact, we're part of the organization CHEJ, so I know there are a lot of other organizations in similar situations. What are the things that you find work in communities like that, where it's not just a community of color, but where there's a real cultural barrier between the people who are oppressed and the people who have the power?
Yeah, let me just reflect on that hearing, because your testimony and all was incredibly wonderful. It was a great reward for me to hear it. For those of you who weren't there, I presume some of you weren't, it was a testimony, but there was a long line of folks who got up and spoke about the Environmental Justice Bill, which was a very simple bill, very clever bill. In Massachusetts, we have a part of our wildlife protection program that creates some things called critical habitats, and there's certain kind of facilities and certain kind of activities you can't place or site near critical habitats because of the fear of endangering our natural fauna and flora. And the environmental justice community put together a very nice bill, very simple, very sweet, just saying that the state should identify critical environmental justice communities and give them the same rights that endangered plants and animals have. And it was just so simple, so direct and clear that it was very wonderful to see the kind of testimony on that. And I think one of the most moving parts of that was to hear young people, some of the, I'll call them kids, but they were young adults, who basically stood up and tried to present in very forceful terms their own feelings about what it means to be endangered and how important it is from communities of color that there be special protections. I thought that was just great. And of course, I was very pleased that you added on to that. And by the way, protect the toxic use reduction program. That's a good idea. As you probably know, the toxic use reduction program, the bill to gut the law was not moved forward, largely because of resistance from the environmental community and the communities in Massachusetts. We are still negotiating over a redrafting of something which would be a reform of that. And I'm sorry to say that the administration, partly because of a governor that took off for bigger agendas in Canada and left us without a governor for a while and then a new governor and with other agendas. And it's been very, very hard to get the attention that I think we need to both protect and then also to advance toxic use reduction in Massachusetts. So I would just say we're going to be back in the legislature again this spring, and I hope you're there with us. It would be very, very valuable to us. Thank you.
The stuff you've done in Lawrence is just fabulous. I mean, we've been following it very carefully. We put it in our newsletter, and you know, you guys should totally be congratulated. And it is really hard to keep a long-term effort going, especially when you're beginning with these big elephant monster problems. And the one way that we talk with folks about how do you do that is to bring people together as much as you can. Instead of talking about the incinerator or whatever the issue is that you're fighting, is to bring them together in a positive meeting. And the whole meeting, the rules are that we can only talk about positive, proactive things that we would like to see happen in Lawrence or a bigger area if you so choose. And so nobody can talk about the incinerator, and nobody can talk about who's got hurt this week and who's sick and what politician is misbehaving. But what they have to talk about is only positive things. And you begin to make a list. You know, you have coffee and donuts or us in Niagara Falls, we used to have beer and wine. But whatever you're culturally want to do. And you put the newsprint in the room. It's like, and you just say, you know, you dream. There's no, it's out-of-the-box thinking. It's out-of-the-box dreaming. It's out-of-the-box visionary. I mean, in the same fashion you're talking about here, toxic waste reduction and substitution and sustainable. I mean, you know, you could look at them and say, you've got to be nuts. I mean, this is like way out there. But it isn't. And it's becoming a reality that we've seen right here in our own backyard. So if you did this and put this list up, and then of that list, you decide to pick two things or three things. I think three is a little much. But if you pick two things, then you're going to work on two sides of this issue. One is about pro something. Maybe it's building a new park. Maybe it's, you know, whatever it is. And the other is the anti-incineration, the anti-air pollution, the anti-mercury and all of this stuff. And then as you move forward, you'll find when the things you're working on pro will start to gather more folks. You know, folks that aren't as concerned about the incinerator or aren't concerned about whatever. And then those folks will then have more power with them and have more people to join in. And you could eventually move to take over the city of Lawrence by putting your own people in office. That's a five-year, it's not a 1 or 2 year thing, but it's a five-year long-term sort of effort. But if one of your visions is, you know, by 2007, we would like folks who really care about the people and the economy and the environment and urban planning and all this other stuff in our city council, and that's our goal, then it's like, what are the pro things are going to bring in those other folks that aren't already with you. Your folks will see the pro things and actually get, it's sort of uplifting. And it's just a way to do it in which you can attract more people and you can diversify what you're doing. And eventually, probably in 5 years, you would become more of a multi-issued organization. And, you know, it could all be one in sort of one house, sort of like we have the kids campaign, we have healthcare without harm, and we have dioxin, then we have our organizing. You know, it could all be in one house, or it could break off, which healthcare without harm is doing as we speak, you know, and become their own institutions. But it's an institution that came from the bottom up that has the values, the root values that you all believe in, and the vision of how to get there. And generally, because not everybody is in-the-box thinkers. I mean, I just think grassroots folks are just like the most creative thinkers. You know, once you go to college, it sort of stops you from thinking out of the box. You really have to struggle very, very hard. You know, it's true. It's like, out of the box. What box? You know, they don't even get the box sometimes. But we need them for other things. I mean, they're very valuable for many, many of the other things. Many of those other things. But they're so creative that it'll grow and prosper. And you can be very successful in that way. And it really is giving people a balance, because people can't just fight anti all the time. It's just way too depressing. The other thing I suggest is that it almost comes like a social club at some point. And you're probably already there. Is one of the things that we did that also was very helpful to the organization and to folks in the community is that every other week on like a Saturday, there was a gathering of people, and they had to bring their partners or spouses, no children allowed. And what that did was people who were really focused on the anti or the pro, and their spouses and partners generally aren't, you know, that so they have other things they have to do. And this way you intermix it, so then it becomes even more of a community because you're sort of forcing your spouse or your partner to come and join with you and meet these people, and they develop relationships. So it's a way also to build the spirituality of sort of being in a community, and then it's less likely to break and fall apart and go away.
Is there anything else that is like
Well, it's a long-term program. I mean, there generally isn't anything unless you have something like Bhopal that's going to catch their attention. You know, it really, and I think people have to think long-term, which is really hard to do, because things are happening now, and people are hurt now, and communities are suffering now, and families are suffering now, and workers are suffering now. But it's really a long-term thing, and I don't know what could go boom and get their attention. I mean, I wish I did, because I would probably find a way to make it happen if it wasn't damaging to... I think it is. I mean, one of the things actually that came out of September 11th, which I think is a positive, if you can find any in there, is that what it's made community people feel like more community people. I mean, we had, right after September 11th in Virginia, we had this, like, tornado go through and knocked all these trees down, and the folks who come out and usually clean up that mess from the county didn't have to do a thing because all the neighbors were out and they were using, you know, there was this whole phenomenon happening about, you know, we're going to help each other and, you know, we're no longer waiting and yelling in the phone at the people who didn't come out. And I don't know the scientific world, but I have to imagine something like that is happening. But I think what really is happening is that the science is being used as the reason to do nothing and back off. You know, in the same way Right to Know is, and other sort of things, it's being used in the opposite way. You know, especially the whole, I mean, because I'm from Washington, where the anthrax thing is a big deal. You know, a couple of my neighbors worked at the post office that those letters went through, but, you know, it's just, you know, I mean, I'm hoping at some point it will, because people now realize this tiny little bit of anthrax is called this huge problem, and that we have to find a way to translate that in our messages to get it to people. But then you have the other side. I think science is a good tool to use, but the problem with science is it can be so vigorously argued from the other side that it's always... I think it was 2020 who told me, or no, it was Ted Koppel, who said, you know, Lois, we'd like to talk about this stuff, but you put your stuff up there and say it's really, really terrible, whatever it might be, to the workers or to the community, and then the opponents come in, and he didn't call them the opponents, but the other side comes in and says that it's really, really okay. And the public walks away from a program like that, shrugging their shoulders. And so that's where the science sort of gets caught up in what we call the dueling experts, and nobody wins, where, you know, if we can figure out another way to frame it and not use the science per se as a way to move a new message, but, you know, frame it in a way we can move the new message, and by the way, this is what people have been talking about in reference to chemical whatever or workplace exposure or community exposure. But I think it has to be taken out of the science circle, translated in lay language, and moved in that way, because there's less sort of dueling experts that confuse the public, and the media can't do a clean story as they like to do.
My name is Eduardo Cicada. I'm here for the Work Environment at UMass Lowell. And as you can see by my accent, I'm very interested in the international perspective on what you said, because your talk was very focused on the analysis of what's going on in the U.S., but it's been my experience that more and more the alliances that we're trying to build and we need to build to win against the big corporations that are polluters, and not American polluters, they're global polluters right now. So I would like to know, how do you see this discussion in this perspective that you told us at a more international level, especially how do you see our ability to build international networks that actually beat the same drum in several countries? How about around the Right to Know campaign for the Americas? How about pollution prevention campaign for the Americas? Since we're dealing more and more with free trade in the Americas, how do you see the possibilities for us to win in a much bigger level than only one country? Still consider the United States one country. It's big, but it's only one. And we have many others in the Americas that are actually getting the dirtier industries being exported over and over and over. And what happened here in your time, maybe early 80s, I've seen happening in many countries in Latin America as we speak, the same kinds of fights, the same kinds of problems with the hazardous waste and Superfund issues being taught in the agenda of unions and communities and many of these countries?
Well, it's actually, we are working internationally and trying to focus on that and build those bases. I mean, one example is when Healthcare Without Harm, which is an international campaign, got off the ground, it began here in the U.S. around medical waste incinerators and transforming those into some other way to deal with medical waste and purchasing, so they wouldn't purchase things that had to be thrown out and weren't toxic in the burning, like PVC and mercury. So that campaign got sort of off the ground here. We learned a lot from it, and then we took it across the country. And actually the banner we're using, I mean across the globe, the banner we're using for that dioxin, another one, is really around the persistent organic pollutants and really talking about those and developing trust and allies from other countries around that issue to try and see what is it we can do collectively. And at the treaty discussion in South Africa around POPs, there was a lot of that sort of interaction and getting to know each other of leadership from the communities that dot the world about how can we move forward. And they did an excellent, the U.S. was the blocker of the Persistent Organic Pollutant Treaty, by the way. We were totally the bad guys, which is not at all surprising. So, you know, we really needed their support and they needed our support. So we've developed a sort of network around persistent organic pollutants. And within that network, we sort of do this self-help where, you know, if you have a, from Germany, if you have this thing that we can use in the U.S., or if you have this in the U.S. that we can use in South Africa or in Costa Rica, you know, that we could go and join. But it is tough, and it's hard to fight internationally on corporations because in the U.S. we have more control and they're into more imaging in public relations, which is not as much so in other countries. In fact, that's the whole issue of them trying to get everybody to look the same and buy the same products regardless of what culture you're from and where you're from and trying to change that. So we're working on it, but it's a very, very slow process. And part of it is that, you know, the organizing in this country for a long time wasn't moving forward, so there wasn't new blood really coming in. And because there wasn't new blood coming in, we were already overtaxing the leadership that we did have, and that's also changing now too. But it's tough. We're going after a number of corporations around PVC, which are multinational corporations, and trying to figure out what to do with them. And we haven't experimented there, but we are trying to do that from a toxics level. We've always worked with other countries on a one-to-one basis around a particular toxic or a particular city or a particular chemical, but not in the sense of really making that network matter. And the Healthcare Without Harm network really is very strong and is growing dramatically. And that's about products and that's disposal. And we actually have a contest out there. I don't know if it's been launched or not. But we're looking for engineers who can figure out how to destroy PVC plastic with chlorine in it, how they could destroy it in a very, 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 very backwoods area with no resources so that they can continue to give shots, for example, for HIV treatment and blood tests, but it doesn't get incinerated. You know, what is it we can do with this PVC stuff to properly dispose of it so that we can really feel good about giving them the medicine and the means in which to deliver the medication in a way that's not going to then create a whole different issue of exposure and toxicity amongst the people. So there's a contest out there for anybody who's an engineer and wants to help figure this one out. But you have all those medical supplies, and if we take them into some countries, there's just no way that they can destroy them except for put them in a barrel and burn them, which is a real serious toxic issue, especially with mercury. Are you taking questions, too?
No.
Hello, my name is Amy Klein. I'm a high school environmental science teacher and I'm
helping
my students to come here. I have a couple questions that are a little bit different twists on them. One is I'm curious if the things in your refrigerator have changed over the years about where you buy your food from and how your decisions are changing. as far as what labels are on them and if they're all organic or if it's from, you know, somewhere you know where things are being made. And with that, I was curious about if you find that your children are starting to make different decisions because of your work and your thought process in the Italian household and how things are going. So that's a couple of different things, and I guess this is the third one. Where do you get this patience? I am amazed as to the foresight and the kind of endurance that you carry. And maybe, I'm thinking, maybe it's because of the victories that keep you going. But it's to think and act on a plan that can go for 5 years and that's the end goal. That's amazing to me. So I'm curious, where does that fuel come from?
Well, I have to admit, my refrigerator is embarrassing. I don't think people should choose what they want to eat based on chemicals. I think if people want to be a vegan or eat meat or whatever, they should have the right to do that. And that really what we need to do is figure out how to clean up the food supply. My 11-year-old son will not eat anything but beef, period. And that's it. Now, I know beef is full of dioxins, so I do my best to make sure that it's as fat-free as possible. But, you know, it's unfair, and it's just not right to say, you have to eat this way because we poisoned everything else. And then people who don't understand the poisoning because we haven't reached out and talked to them yet are being poisoned consciously and deliberately, it's sort of like the experiment without their permission, without their consent. And, you know, who has the right to do that? And so as a result of that, I refuse to just go out and buy vegetables and organic foods and stuff like that. I mean, to a certain extent, that's also my passion to say, I want to put in my refrigerator, and I'll know if it's unhealthy because it's fatty, you know, or something like that. But I don't want to have to make those choices based on chemicals, only about fat content and sugar content and stuff like that. So my refrigerator is very embarrassing. What was the second one? Did you write down?
Children's decisions. Are your children's decisions affected at all by how you've been living?
My children's decisions are, I have four children, a 29-year-old, a 25-year-old, a 17-year-old, and an 11-year-old. And my children are all uniquely different, as children should be. My 16, 17-year-old is just like ready to be a politician and take on the world. You know, enough of the stuff. He goes to school board meetings, and talks to the school board about things that need to be changed. He's almost always the only student, and I don't encourage him to go. He asked me if he can have a ride, so he does this completely on his own. My daughter is an artist. And, you know, she's not an activist at all. She's thinking about it now. I don't know that it's changed hers. My son is just this computer nerd who makes a fortune doing computer engineering. But he thinks I'm doing it okay, and he doesn't need to get involved until after he's settled down. So that's where he is. And my 11-year-old worries constantly, and I don't know whether it's because of what I talk about all the time, or whether it's just the nature of the child, because again, you know, all kids are so very different. And we were at the Twin Towers actually just not that long before the building was hit, and so he just, you know, is still trying to even deal with that. You know, he'll ask what chemicals are in his hamburger and stuff like that, but I don't know. I think they're very independent people. I think they, all four of them are like willing to stand up and say what they feel. They're respectful, so they do it in a respectful sort of way, unlike their mother sometimes. They're actually a step better in that direction. But, you know, I hope they grow up and be somebody. And I just love my work. You know, and it's not the work, you know, of coming to places like this and talking to large groups that I love best, although I do like that. It's going into these communities, you know, like the Lawrence community, and seeing the folks there just like, oh my God, we can't do anything. It's bigger than us. It's scary. We've never. And then you go back a year later, you know, providing little nudges or little help. I mean, we certainly aren't responsible for the success of that group. And you go back and like these people are standing there at the podium and banging on, we will not accept that. You know, or they're testifying at the state house or different places about other issues. And for me, I mean, what I want to see is communities grow strong. You know, I'm a victim of somebody else making all the decisions because I decided to be passive and just say, well, you can't fight City Hall, so what? And, you know, realizing that how many of us were victimized by that attitude. It really wasn't even the chemicals. It was the attitude that we carried. So every time I see a group, a form, and become strong, and think about where do I go after this, or I can't keep on just fighting incinerators, I need to move on to something else, you know, I just find very empowering, very inspirational, and keep going. And I guess lastly, I'm mad as hell. You know, I mean, my children almost died at Love Canal. And no one, and it too, like our food supply, it too was a conscious, deliberate decision by the county, the city, and EPA. They knew in 1976, 2 years before I found out about Love Canal, that our children were at risk. They had a consultant report that said that. And they did a cost-benefit analysis, and they decided what my family's life was worth, and whether it was worth the $20 million, my family and my neighbors, obviously, and whether it was worth the $20 million they assumed it would cost to clean up Love Canal. And they said no. I mean, they said it in much flowery language, but they said no. You know, and it's just like, well, who has a right to say no? Why are my children not worth $20 million and my neighbor's children collectively not worth spending $20 million? And how many times this decision is made over and over again in the workplace, in the community, in drinking water, in air pollution? I mean, it's just, you know, it's ethically wrong. And so I'm still angry. So I'm going to make sure that wherever this happens, if I'm there, at least maybe in that community, it won't happen, or people will have enough skills and attitude to challenge it, because it's just not right.
I will take it. I know you didn't come to hear me, but I just want to speak to that last question, because there are younger people here. We've been talking this afternoon about what a horribly polluted and toxic environment we live in, and so to that extent, I agree with Lois that there really isn't anything you can do, you know, just individually, like change your eating to prevent that exposure. On the other hand, I think it's important for a number of reasons to make conscious decisions about how we take care of ourselves, and eating organic food to the extent we can, I think is very important. One, if I'm living in a toxic sewer, then if there's some way I can just add a little bit less to my system, that I think is potentially can make some difference, and it can help keep my immune system that much stronger. The other thing is that we've been talking here today about encouraging alternative systems of production, and one of the major areas of production is how we produce our food. And if we buy organic food, then someone's going to have to sell it. And that means more farmers will be able to grow it and make their living off of it. I think another thing that's really important about food is if we can buy food locally from local farmers and local food producers instead of from the agribusiness, which is centered in California or Texas, that we help support the growth of a sustainable regional economy. I go through this with my own students a lot because I really emphasize the importance of working on the social aspects of our health problems, much more so than the individual aspects of them, dealing with things one-on-one, one person at a time. I have trouble thinking about how we improve our public health one person at a time. But I think every act, like eating consciously, is a way of disciplining ourselves to build the strength we need to take the leadership and to work with others to win these efforts, to make this into a world that we can all live comfortably in. So I just wanted to add those. My daughter is really caught in between having grown up being encouraged to eat that way and wanting to eat just like everybody else at this point. So I don't know what her decisions will be. All right, there were other people. There were Carla and Jen. So...
Well, first of all, it's true, you know? I just want to honor and recognize those folks who fought for me before I was even here. There's actually a lot of... the majority of community groups we work with are led by women. And so women's conversation and the issues around the struggles for women's rights many years ago, you know, come back to play in those conversations, especially... as it relates to southern women who are still like a zillion years behind northern women in their abilities to play different roles. And in fact, southern women don't protest, I was told. And I said, well, gee, that's a problem, you know, in our line of work. And they said, well, we figured out how to deal with it. We get parade permits. And then we have parades instead of protests so that it's acceptably culturally. But... you know, a lot of that is still floating out there, and a lot of people are talking about the same thing that was talked about back in the beginning in the 70s about women's rights and looking at some of the other movements, too. The other thing that I think is important about all of those movements, especially the women's movement, is that it was a campus-based movement for the most part. And because it was a campus-based movement, the women who came out of that were just... you know, they entered the workforce, and then they sort of began to change the whole workplace and influence it on the way up. So it was really powerful in the sense of when it occurred, what the results were, and how they actually made that stuff happen. And so in the same fashion the gentleman asked me about Lawrence, you know, it's like we're fighting this incinerator, but how do we, like, then go to the next stage and make this thing happen? It's the same sort of model that we use. And there's still a very strong women's movement out there today. But even that one, you look at that and what's happened to that movement, it's really sort of, you know, it's not growing either. And I guess that's part of my concern that I was talking about earlier. Where are the movements and where are they growing? And actually, the young people's movement is probably one of the fastest growing of the sort of institutional movements that are out there. And again, critically important. But where is the women's movement? You know, where is the peace movement? Where are all those folks hanging out now? I know they all got jobs somewhere, but, you know, where are all these activists that used to be in the front lines today, and where are the people that they theoretically mentored? What are they doing? And so it's like, it's sort of scary. And one of the things that we're consciously looking at those various movements, consciously thinking about, is how do we keep the people we mentor involved? And if they don't want to do environmental work anymore, you know, how do we then plug them into economic work? Or how do we plug them into looking at school boards and those decisions and you know, the educational process and sort of basically the root causes of most of their problems, and how do we plug them in somewhere else so that they don't go away and, you know, sort of leave the whole social justice scene?
We'll take one more question from Carla, and then we'll break because it's a little after 3. But I do want to let you know that some of the River Ambassadors from Lowell have come to meet with Lois and talk about their work, and everybody's welcome to meet with them as well. So Carla and then Lois will respond, and we'll close up the formal part of the meeting here.
Because he talked about how materials really matter. And on one hand, we're talking about us, and on the other hand, we're talking about them and them being big corporations. How do we get to the point, or how do we bring these movements ahead to get the corporations to the table to start discussing alternative production processes? I have another, let's say 20, 30 years in the field. I'm kind of just starting out. The more I learn, the more I'm just horrified at, how much has gone on. And I'm actually teaching an environmental health class at UNH now, and it's just been a wonderful experience because the students now have their eyes open to all the horrible stuff that's been going on with cop-ups and big corporations owning, us, basically. So what is your vision for the future? How do we, in this political time, without the women's movement being so strong, how do we move ahead to try to make these changes?
Well, how many hours do we have? It is a very good question. It's an incredibly important question because that's the heart of the issue. And I don't think there's a simple answer in the sense that this is the path one should take. I think it's a matter of trying to figure out how to do it and do it in a very diverse way all over the place. For example, looking at the right-to-know model and then suggesting that we're going to have a green guide coming out for building a green school, which will also be talking about material use. And, it's sort of proactive, it's very positive, it's warm and fuzzy. And so it'll be accepted readily into the community and the people we're trying to reach. But in any case, taking that, and we have guidelines about how school boards and local governments and state governments should adopt these guidelines. So what we're hoping to do, and the same is true with the poison schools, trying to get them sited in areas that are not contaminated, is to begin to pass these small ordinances or laws at the school board level and then try to move them up. And as the industry sees these things changing, seeing that we no longer are going to use PVC linoleums on school floors because that's just a nasty, terrible product. And instead, there's an increased call for natural linoleum, that the market will shift. And we've seen that in a number of other things. so that's one approach that we could use. An approach that was used around PVC in healthcare was to talk to a bunch of folks at hospitals and sort of build a base. And then what they wanted to do was get PVC out of the healthcare industry for similar reasons. It's just not healthy. And so what they did is they passed all these ordinances. And it's a very good story in the sense that it gives you, this is what I mean by diverse ideas. They passed an ordinance in San Francisco, in the Berkeley area, that said that the city will no longer tolerate dioxin-related releases. I mean, it's sort of, it's just an ordinance. It doesn't mean anything. But because they were trying to pass it, and the chlorine industry was furious, there was all this conversation, and it was in the front page, and people were protesting, and the conversation got larger and louder. And as a result of that, everybody sort of understood this is a very, very, very controversial issue, because industry is saying one thing, and the other thing, there's mom with their babies, and, hospitals and doctors and nurses saying, well, we're about healthcare without harm. How can we keep that oath when we're doing this? And so we built a base across the country, and then asked Kaiser. Kaiser is the number one distributor or purchaser of healthcare products in our country. So if we could get Kaiser Permanente to agree to stop buying, to phase out PVC products, by them doing so, they will change the market because the demand will be alternatives, and because they have to make the most for Kaiser, that other people will be able to benefit in a cheaper product line that's non-contaminated. So that's another way to move it, really looking at the product and how do you affect product and purchasing and change it that way. But I think it's all of those things, and that someone really needs to do it. And I guess that's where I'm at, is trying to figure out who wants to play in this game. Who's out there and who's playing, and really figure out the map. I mean, if you want to achieve this, this is not about just schools, and it's not just about healthcare without harm. It's not just about dioxin, and it's not just about, it's really all of us. And so this is where we could experiment. If we lost Kaiser Permanente, issue, we could try it from another way, and then that will grow into sort of a model that we can move things across the country and eventually, hopefully, across the globe. So I think the short answer is lots of different things, depending on what it is and who's at the top, which company, and how can we affect that company. And it's really that kind of mixed mosaic of approaches and models and ideas. And don't forget my...
Yes, yes, Paul.
I've been good about keeping my mouth shut today, but I think one of the really exciting things about today that I want to acknowledge is there are two groups of people, and I think we're talking a lot about the future, and I don't want to give short shrift, and I think a lot of people are still here. I'd like to give sort of a round of applause to a couple of groups, and Amy talked about their group at the Essex Aquaculture Tech. They have an environmental science program. And these folks took our 40-hour hazardous waste health and safety training. It was a great group, and meeting those folks makes me feel really confident about the kind of people that are entering the environmental field in the future. And then the River Ambassadors, a wonderful group here in Lola, has been a lot about the environment in this town. They really wanted to meet Lola, but they've even done their own play that involved the canal. And it's a great, enthusiastic group. So I think we've got a lot to be real confident about in the future. So I'd like to just give them a particular round of applause.
And I'd like to thank Paul Morrison, Jen Dobransky, and Perry Honeychurch for doing all the work involved in getting all this set up and making all the arrangements. And they weren't responsible for the lack of heat, so you can give them thanks anyway. And for those of you who are ever thinking about coming to UMass Lowell, I'm sure by the time you get here, there will be heat. So don't let that discourage you. The one question we didn't answer was the question about patience. Lois, I'll speak for Lois, but Lois says she's really mad. I think when we talk about long-term plans, we're not talking about just waiting for something to happen. We're talking about working our way to there. It's very hard. I know I have a lot more patience now than I did when I was a lot younger. but it is hard to be patient, and I think that's good because we shouldn't have to wait for this too much longer. Just so you know what Paul was saying, the River Ambassadors are a group of Lowell High School activists, environmental activists, who work in Lowell to raise environmental issues. So we're not talking in code. That's who they are. I am honored to be sitting up here with Lois Gibbs and honored to have her come and visit us at the university. And thank you so much. Thank you for all that you've given us. Thank everybody else for coming. Please stick around if you have some more time, and we'll see you around doing this work.